Thank you very much, Olivier, for the kind invitation. I was asked by Olivier to speak about something which is emerging in those illiberal countries of the European Union, like Hungary and Poland especially, but in some other countries as well, namely a kind of constitutional theory of that emerging illiberal regimes. So I prepared something which is about this new phenomenon of illiberal constitutional theory, which, as I will try to show, it's nothing new in it. It goes back to old illiberal theories, in a sense that illiberalism here and elsewhere, it's actually considered as a kind of critique of liberalism, obviously, but probably in two ways. The critic applies both to the theory of liberalism, but also applies to liberal societies. In my limited time, which is not that limited that I thought originally, but because I was told to speak for 20 minutes, I do not want to misuse my extended time. So I will talk about this theory, probably going a little bit over this to issues which was raised by Miriam's highly interesting issues. And even though she said that the Iranian regime is probably very hard to compare with any other regimes, probably there are some basis for comparison here. So let me start by this Hungarian approach of illiberal democracy. You may have heard about a famous speech of Prime Minister Viktor Orban in 2014, when he declared that Hungary is aiming at an illiberal democracy. And similarly, he also openly declared that when his Fidesz party won the elections in 2010, and they got a two-third majority of the seats in the parliament, due to a disproportionate election system. This two-third majority of the seats allowed them to change the constitution, and they enacted a brand new constitution in 2011. And by the way, without any contribution to either other parliamentary parties, opposition parties, or with any civil society organizations, any legal scholarship, any NGO contribution. It was an imposed constitution by this two-third majority of the Fidesz MPs in the parliament. So Orban also declared that the aim of this new constitution wasn't a liberal constitution. He said liberal constitutions failed in Europe, so therefore they are aiming at an illiberal one. Whatever it means, I try to figure this out. Obviously, a political leader like Orban is not a constitutional theorist who defines what really illiberalism and illiberal constitutionalism means here, but there are some court ideologists who help us to figure out what is really behind those claims about illiberalism. By the way, last year, 4 years after this mentioned speech in 2014, Orbán also declared that what is, in his view, illiberalism is equals to Christian democracy, and in his interpretation, Christian democracy is per definition illiberal. You can imagine that what was the consequence of that kind of statement in the European People's Party, in the European Parliament, which consists mostly from Christian Democratic Party, especially the CDU from Germany. But anyway, this was a kind of protection by Orbán at that time, a year ago, against harsh criticism from his own political party group about the backsliding of democracy in Hungary altogether. So let us see those ideologues, what they are saying when trying to interpret the supreme leader's words about illiberalism. András Lánci, who is an influential political scientist and advisor to Viktor Orbán from the very beginning of his premiership, currently the rector of one of the largest Hungarian universities. So his critique of liberalism in a book also published in English called Political Realism and Wisdom, he actually expresses or elaborates a kind of outright rejection of liberalism as an utopian ideology, emphasizing that the main characteristic of liberalism is modernity and progressivism. That is why it's very, very interesting when Miriam was talking about the preamble of the Iranian constitution and about the pursuit of modern society. So here, certainly, one of the main enemies is modernity. In that sense, Lánci also likens liberalism to communism, which is a very, very common kind of characteristic of all those illiberal ideas or theories. A similar court ideologist of the Polish Peace Party of Jarosław Kaczyński, Richard Legutko, who is, by the way, besides being a university professor of philosophy, he's also a member of the European Parliament. He published a book, I try to find the title of the book, also in English, and in this book, the demon in democracy, totalitarian temptations in free societies. He, similarly to Lánci, refers to liberalism and liberal democracy and communism as ideas of modernization and progress. Of course, those illiberal theories or ideologies are not only present in those East Central European backsliding member states. There are a lot of other recent theories, both in the United States and elsewhere. Let me mention two of them. Patrick Deneen's book, Why Liberalism Failed, published in 2018, as well as Yoram Hazony's book, The Virtue of Nationalism, also published last year. They all conflate liberal democracy with contemporary progressivism. So this is a joint characteristic, all of those ideologies. But what is the main root of those illiberal theories? Needless to say, first of all, Carl Schmitt. So Carl Schmitt, and there are even some recent research which very much points out Carl Schmitt's theory, besides the well-known analysis of Carl Schmitt. For instance, Stephen Holmes, a constitutional political theorist at NYU, draws attention to Schmitt's work, a not well-known work entitled Römischer Katholizismus und politische Form, in which Schmitt refers to even American financiers and Russian Bolsheviks as the main representatives of liberalism. So we can even see very, very up-to-date kind of references in illiberal theories in Schmitt's work. You may have heard about the campaign of the Hungarian government against George Soros, claiming that he is the main enemy of all illiberal regimes because of being a financier and being a kind of modern Bolshevik. So without going into the details of Carl Schmitt's influence to those illiberal democracy, the obvious relationship is certainly Schmitt's argument about the incompatibility of liberalism with democracy. So in Schmitt's interpretation, democracy can only be a kind of plebiscitary democracy based on the unity of the nation, the unity of the people, which refers to what Miriam was talking about, both the anti-pluralist character of those kind of theories, as well as the reference to the people as a united entity. And almost necessarily, this kind of interpretation of democracy in those modern representation of illiberal thinking becomes an anti-constitutional idea. I do not want to go into the details of the relationship between illiberalism and constitutionalism here, but just to make my argument here, I do not think that there is such a thing as illiberal constitutionalism, as I also do not think that there is such a thing as authoritarian constitutionalism, despite the fact that there are well-known and respected constitutional scholars from Mark Tushnet to others who claim that there is such a thing as authoritarian constitutionalism. So in the following, let me try to categorize all those types of attempts how to theorize this kind of illiberal regime from a constitutional point of view. So what kind of theories appear, especially in Hungary, to legitimize the system? One of these is majoritarianism, or the Westminster system of constitutional orders. One of the current constitutional court justices, who is, by the way, also a professor of political science and constitutional law at the same time, Béla Pokol, was the first who argued after the enactment of the Hungarian constitution enacted in 2011, that nothing is really, really special here. The Hungarian constitutional system has been changed from an originally parliamentary democratic system to a kind of Westminster system based on the majority. He even refers in his writings, many of them appeared in English, on the unity of power. So he openly denies any kind of separation of power, any kind of pluralism of the exercise of power, and explicitly refers to the unity of power. Besides the fact that the unity of power was one of the main characteristic of Lenin's theory on state power, denying any kind of separation of, or division of the power, it's more or less obvious, at least for me, that this kind of characterization has nothing to do with the Westminster system. The Westminster system is certainly a special type of parliamentary system with a strong emphasis of the sovereignty of the parliament, but not with an absolute sovereignty of the parliament. And not only since the late 90s, when the Human Rights Act was introduced, and later on the Supreme Court was entitled to exercise judicial review, but from the very beginning, separation of power is not alien to the Westminster system. Why those countries like Hungary and in the meanwhile already Poland since 2015, the change of government, these systems are systematically dismantle all kind of separation of power, all kind of checks and balances, both constitutional and political checks on the executive power. So I think that those kind of characterization of the system as a purely majoritarian system has nothing to do with the characteristic of these systems. It does not mean that the Hungarian or the Polish constitutional system, in the case of Poland, since the government did not have the constitution making majority, they have to violate the 97 constitution by anti-constitutional laws. But anyway, in neither of these two systems are any kind of effective control over the executive power, even though constitutional courts do exist in those systems, as opposed to the Westminster system. Even the competences of those constitutional courts are more or less the same as it was the case after the democratic transition in 89. There are some curtailment of the competences, but the most important element of dismantling those institutions is to pack them. So all those courts, both the Hungarian and Polish court, consist of exclusively members who are loyal to the government, elected by them. So in that sense, the institutional structure is seemingly there, but it's totally unfunctional. Let me turn to the second kind of legitimization of this system, which relates to the previous one. This is using the theory of political constitutionalism, as argued by many well-known constitutional and political scholars from my colleague at EUR, Richard Bellamy, who is one of the proponents of political constitutionalism, to more legal scholars. The idea of political constitutionalism to give the final word to the legislation. So either by not having a constitutional review at all, or having a very weak constitutional review, like Stephen Gardbaum's theory on Commonwealth constitutionalism, which argues for a kind of deliberative mechanism between the legislature and the court, with the final say remaining in the possession of the legislature. So the courts, if exists, they express their concern of constitutionality, and the final decision making body is the legislature, considering those kind of concerns raised by the courts. Or another recently developed idea is the democratic constitutionalism idea by Robert Post from Yale or his colleague at Yale, Eva Siegel, who are saying that yes, courts, even the US Supreme Court, being very, very powerful court, should take into account other aspects but the constitutional theory. They should take into account the changes in the society. Their main argument that this kind of democratic constitutionalism led to the decision of the US Supreme Court in the gay rights case, that the judges have realized that there is a kind of changed opinion in the society, more accepting gay marriages, and therefore they changed also their mind. So all those have nothing to do with the illiberal constitutional theory. Those theorists, very very interestingly, mostly constitutional court judges, in the case of Hungary, also one judge at the Polish Constitutional Court, Lech Morawski, who just passed away recently, he also argued that actually constitutional courts should rather use a kind of political constitutionalism, which is again a very, very strange idea, but certainly has nothing to do with what the Polish Constitutional Court is doing, namely just following the comments of the political leadership of the Polish ruling party. Very, very interestingly, in Hungary, three current constitutional court judges wrote two books which also argue against the judicial review, against their own jobs, saying that it's not the judges who should decide on finally on constitutional issues. So I do not want to go into more details. There are a lot of followers of those judges and ideologues, all arguing that actually nothing special happened, just a curtailment of a very powerful legal constitutionalism approach. There are also scholars, for instance, Adam Czarnota, who is a Polish constitutional scholar teaching in Sydney, who argues that actually these kind of changes in the constitutional review power is a kind of consequence of the legal constitutionalism, the two activist legal constitutionalism in the very beginning of the transition in 89, the very powerful constitution of courts, both in Poland and Hungary, had the reaction that actually changed the approach of judicial review to a more limited and certainly government loyal approach to this. And the third element I would like to talk about this kind of legitimation is the use, or I would better frame it as the misuse of the concept of constitutional identity. As you know, constitutional identity is a concept which is very, very much debated, first of all within the European Union since the early 70s, when the German Constitutional Court started to use the concept of constitutional pluralism, constitutional identity, saying that even though the European Union is a constitutional value community, there must be place for some pluralism within this European constitutional system, and there must be place some identity for the member states. So these constitutional courts, both the Hungarian and the Polish, very much use this kind of constitutional identity argument. If you look at some Hungarian constitutional court decisions on constitutional identity, you will find dozens of references to the so-called Zollange jurisprudence of the German Constitutional Court, or in Poland, even references to scholarly works of constitutional pluralism. McCormick or Neil Walker are frequently quoted by those justices. Let me only mention one case in the jurisprudence of the Hungarian Constitutional Court, which was probably the most disturbing sign of this kind of abuse of constitutional identity. When the European Council decided in early 2016, after the refugee crisis in Europe, about a relocation plan for European member states, the Hungarian government started to deny any kind of involvement in this relocation. And first the Hungarian government tried to initiate a referendum, saying that Hungary is not willing to contribute to any kind of relocation. After this referendum failed, because there was no real interest by the people to participate in such referendum, or at least not on the level of the requested threshold, then the government tried to enact a constitutional amendment on this, which also failed. Then the Constitutional Court came to the rescue of the Hungarian government and issued a decision in the end of 2016 saying that complying with the relocation plan would violate Hungary's constitutional identity. And what the decision contains is a total nonsense, arguing that Hungary is a very homogeneous society, never really lived together with peoples with different cultures. Therefore, all the refugees who are most likely are from a different culture, from a different religion, different from the original Christian Hungarian traditional religion, they would destroy this kind of culture in Hungary. Therefore, Hungary denies on that identity basis the compliance with the relocation plan. this year the court again repeated in a case when the government changed the criminal law, criminalizing all those NGOs who provide help to asylum seekers. So it became a criminal act to provide legal aid to asylum seekers in Hungary. In that decision, which the Constitutional Court found constitutional, I mean the law, the court again refers to the Hungarian constitutional identity being alien to other cultures and religions. So, how much time I have?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Okay. So, in conclusion, I would only I wanted to prove that all those justifications of illiberal constitutionalism are certainly have nothing to do with the constitutionalism at all. Those are legitimations of a non-constitutional authoritarian regime. And here I would like to a little bit go into this characteristic, not about Linz and Stepan's differentiation between the authoritarian and the autocratic systems. Certainly Hungary or Poland, for that matter, are currently authoritarian systems. But there is something which can be misleading, and this is the frequent use of populism as a characteristic of those systems. So in many even scientific writings refer to the Hungarian or the Polish system as a populist system. Let me make it clear my opinion. I guess even though there is a huge amount of populist rhetoric in Hungary and in Poland as well, but this system is not a populist system in the substance. Populist systems usually are anti-elitist system. They claim that they are representing the people against the corrupt elite. The Hungarian political leadership with Viktor Orbán on top are part of the Hungarian political elite from the very beginning of the democratic transition. They are also not anti-representative, which is also one of the main characteristics of populism. They are very much using the representative system with the disproportionate electoral law to gain power, to keep power. So this has nothing to do with anti-representation. And it also has nothing to do with direct democracy, the claim that the people should decide. Viktor Orbán was the first, when coming to power in 2010, who changed the law on referendum, making it almost impossible. By the way, he fell in his own trap with the mentioned failed referendum, because he increased the threshold so high that even his cause was not enough to reach the threshold. So he is not using the people. He is very much using the people as a reference point, as a rhetoric. he was the one who, when lost his first term power in 2002, after one parliamentary term, he said, the nation cannot be in opposition. In other words, he represents the nation, everyone else is outside the nation. Which is a typical populist rhetoric. And of course, as populist rhetoric is certainly an anti-pluralist rhetoric. But what he is really doing is with his own elite, with his own representatives, without really asking the people to keep his power as long as he can, also by changing the electoral law. So Hungary has not anymore a democratic free electoral system. In other words, to change this system is almost impossible. Thank you very much. Thank you.